Well, it's great to see you all again today. It doesn't take very long for us to realize in our world that the pull of the world is very strong. And a lot of that is due to the fact that we have apostates among us. And you know what? They don't wear badges. Hello, my name is Apostate. What they do is they come right from within us. And lately I've been studying, learning more about how apostates actually have destroyed the Christian West. And this is probably best chronicled in the book Apostate by Kevin Swanson. He details the history of the Western civilization in the last few centuries. And he talks about people who were in the church and yet have denied the faith. Men like Nathaniel Hawthorne, Mark Twain, John Dewey, Jean-Paul Sartre, Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche. And if you want to add to that some contemporaries, how about Ernest Hemingway and Lady Gaga? People who have been within the church and not held to what they grew up believing and have led others astray. Now, why are they so significant? Swanson says in his book, this is the story of the decline and fall of Western civilization. It's the story of uncommonly powerful men, unfathomably evil men, apostates. Now, what did the apostates teach? We're not going to get into what they all say. But just to give you some samples, John Dewey is one of them. He advocated in the early 20th century that we should eliminate homeschools and replace them all with public education. Why? To take children away from the main influence in their lives, their parents. And that way he could train up a whole generation of people in humanistic philosophy. Charles Darwin also had a Christian background, but concluded that God didn't create, we evolved instead. And need I say much about Karl Marx? As an atheist, has been tremendously influential, not only in the Western world, but throughout the world, saying that there is no God. And then Friedrich Nietzsche declared in 1883, God is dead. 17 years later, in the year 1900, God declared, Nietzsche is dead. His philosophy, though, didn't die with him, because his books have remained. And all of these philosophers, their impact on the Western world cannot be overstated. It affects your life, it affects my life. We confront this every day. So how are you doing? How are you doing resisting the world and welcoming Christ? This is a challenge that we face every day, because these various philosophies are very much ingrained in our Western way of thought and over here in the East as well. They affect the movies we watch. They affect what we see on the computer screens. We seek to replace our emptiness with drugs and alcohol and money and worldly philosophy and music and you name it. It's quite pervasive. And if you're not feeling it, I wonder what you are feeling. Are you feeling anything? So what do we do? We know that God wants us to reject the world, the world's way of thinking. And that's why you came here today. But why? This is a question I'm asking that I think is answered in our passage for today. Why should we reject the world, the world's way of thinking, and embrace God's kingdom? Why would that be so important to fight against worldly philosophy and say no to that, and yet say yes to the things that God values, the things that Christ values. This is what we'll talk about today, again, in the book of Revelation. This is our 17th of 20 messages on the book of Revelation. We're nearing the end as we fast approach the end of the book. Today we're going to cover 2.5 chapters, so I'm going to talk really fast, okay? To answer this question. And what we have already seen are three cycles of judgments: seals, trumpets, and bowls. We finished last week talking about Revelation 16 and these various seven different bowl judgments that God is going to pour out on the world just before Jesus comes. We've already talked about the seals. We've already talked about these trumpets that are sounded and various judgments associated with them. And then the bowls will sound or be poured out. But there's still a little bit left before Christ comes. And that is in a section from chapter 17 to halfway through chapter 19. 17, 18, and up to 19, verse 10. And this is another one of those parenthetical sections you find in the book of Revelation. It doesn't really move the chronology forward, but it does give us some very important information. And this section gives us important information about the last most significant entity in the world that needs to be removed prior to Christ coming. And that is going to end, as we'll see in the next message, with the Battle of Armageddon and the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so what we have here in these two chapters is a kind of a parenthetical word from the sponsor about what really, really matters before the return of Christ. And it's done in the figure of looking back at the ancient city of Babylon, interestingly. And we're going to answer a couple questions related to that. What is going to happen to this entity that chapter 17 calls Babylon? We'll see that in chapter 17 and a little bit into chapter 18. And then what should we do about it? What would be the proper response to recognizing that Babylon will not last forever? We'll see that in the latter half of this passage, chapter 18, 1 to 19, 10. So what will happen to the most evil influence that the world has ever seen? I hope you'll be happy to hear that this world's key entity will fall in the tribulation. There will be not a slow decline, but there will be a quick destruction of this entity called Babylon. And this is what we find in chapter 17. Actually, it kind of goes on a little bit into chapter 18. But this is where we first begin to see that it will fall. This entity is given under the imagery of the harlot, of a beautiful but immoral woman. Seems to be a good way for John, or God, to show John what this entity is actually about. So let's read the first few verses of chapter 17. One of the seven angels who had poured out the seven bowls came over and spoke to me. "Come with me," he said, "and I will show you the judgment that is going to come on the great prostitute who rules over many waters. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her, and the people who belong to this world have been made drunk by the wine of her immorality." So the angel took me in the spirit into the wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that had seven heads and 10 horns, and blasphemies against God were written all over it. The woman wore purple and scarlet clothing and beautiful jewelry made of gold and precious gems and pearls. In her hand she held a gold goblet full of obscenities and the impurities of her immorality. A mysterious name was written on her forehead: Babylon the Great, mother of all prostitutes and obscenities in the world. I could see that she was drunk with the blood of God's holy people who were witnesses for Jesus. I stared at her in complete amazement. Maybe you do too. Maybe you look at her in complete amazement and you say, who in the world is this? Well, she's drunk, which is a bit of a reminder, and she's called Babylon the Great. It's a bit of a reminder of actually what we see in the last verse of Daniel chapter 5. Do you remember the first Babylon? This greatest of the kingdoms up to its point, and how God declared that that kingdom was going to fall by handwriting on the wall. We get our English expression, handwriting. I can see the handwriting on the wall based on Daniel chapter 5. Well, what happened there with Belshazzar, king of Babylon? We know from Herodotus, the Greek historian, that this great city of Babylon with the Euphrates River flowing through it actually fell in one night. It was a massive city, so huge it was so-called unconquerable. The walls are so thick that two chariots could ride along it abreast. And it had a protective moat, and nobody thought that Babylon could fall. But Cyrus, the Persian, cut off the water of the Euphrates River north of the city, diverted the water around the city, lowered the water of the Euphrates going on into the city. His soldiers quickly just went underneath the water, opened up the city gates, let the whole army in. And what normally would take years to put a city like that under siege took only hours. And Daniel 5:30 says, that very night Belshazzar was slain. And Babylon is still a ruins now, centuries later, with the exception of a couple buildings that Saddam Hussein put up. Belshazzar's feast is a reminder that that which we think is so great and so mighty to God, he can have it fall in an evening if he wants to. And the end times Babylon will not last either. It will fall very, very quickly, as we see in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation. Now, we've already gotten into it. I haven't read the whole chapters yet, and I'm not really going to read both chapters. I encourage you to read that at home. But we see some major players here in this chapter. We've already seen there's a prostitute here. She's called Babylon. When you get to the last verse of chapter 17, it says that there is the great city over all the earth. We see that the prostitute's riding the beast. Well, who in the world is that? And then we have this eighth king mentioned in verse 11. And what about these seven heads, seven hills, seven kings? When we get up to verse 10. And then there's 10 horns, and there's also 10 kings. Ah. I thought, how am I going to explain all this all in one message? But you know what? If you look a little bit closer and ask the question, are there really 10 different players here in this chapter? I think the answer is no. We actually have the prostitute is Babylon, is the great city over the earth. So that's actually only one entity. The beast is called the eighth king. And that helps identify who he is. The seven heads, seven hills, seven kings really all are one entity. And then the 10 horns and the 10 kings also should be linked together. So actually, we only have four entities. Four-point outlines are much easier for the audience to handle than 10-point outlines. And so let's do it that way. And what we actually have here in this harlot who's riding this beast with the seven heads and 10 horns on them, we actually have identical symbols here. The prostitute is said to be Babylon, the great city. The beast that she's riding is noted in chapter 13 as the Antichrist, and he's also called the eighth king of verse 11. And then the seven heads are also called seven hills, verse 9, and seven kings, verse 10. That's helpful. And then the 10 horns are the 10 kings. Do you catch what I'm saying here? We really only have four entities here. So who are they, though? It depends on who you ask. Because there's, as you would guess, many different opinions on all this, and I'll share with you some of the different opinions and give you my own opinion. We've already seen in Revelation 13 that there are three beasts mentioned in that one. This is certainly not the dragon. The dragon has seven heads and ten horns. But this is probably more like the beast that comes out of the sea in Revelation 13, verse 1 and 2, otherwise known as the Antichrist. We'll see the false prophet when we get to the end of chapter 19, but not for right now. So here is the beast. This is this world ruler who is beast-like or animal-like in his behavior, in his motivation. And he is one who follows the seven kings, according to this passage. Verses 9 and 10 say, "This calls for a mind with understanding. The seven heads of the beast represent the seven hills where the woman rules. They also represent seven kings. Five kings have fallen, the sixth now reigns, and the seventh is yet to come, but his reign will be brief." Okay, so five of them have already come and gone. Well, people try to figure out who these various kings are. And going in the first century, we have various kings that have made their way through the first century. Some, called preterists, which means past, believe that the book of Revelation was written during the time of Nero. Whereas we hold here that it was actually during the time of Domitian, right at the end of the first century. So who are then these five kings that precede the one now? Doesn't look like really we've got five kings preceding Domitian. We actually don't have five kings preceding Nero. I don't think it quite figures out. These preterists see the number 666 in Revelation 13:18 as Nero, so they think that the book was written during that time. But the very first verse of the book, as well as chapter 4, verse 1, says that John's seeing what must soon take place. So he's actually looking to what is future from his standpoint. He's not looking back. And so that removes any doubt whether that's actually Nero or not. So the preterists think these seven kings are seven Roman kings in the first century, and then Nero is that sixth king. But we know that Nero ruled for 14 years. He didn't rule for 42 months, like chapter 13 says. And all the inhabitants of the earth did not worship Nero. So I don't think we're talking about Nero here. It's easy to take Nero out of the picture. It's also easy to take Domitian out of the picture for the same reasons. Even though he claimed to be Lord and God, he didn't get worship from all over the world. And his name doesn't mean 666, and he didn't reign for 42 months either. Domitian reigned for some 15 years. So there's no reference to Nero or Domitian, as some scholars like Greg Beale affirm. Actually, it's very helpful if you go back to the book of Daniel. Daniel 7 mentions four beasts, and Revelation kind of puts all those together. But Daniel 7 talks about seven heads representing four successive kingdoms. Not four kings, but kingdoms. And so it makes sense that we've got successive kingdoms here as well. From four kingdoms to seven kingdoms. And then the Antichrist then would be the eighth of all those kingdoms. So Egypt would be the first of those kingdoms, Assyria the second, Neo-Babylonia, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. These were all historical kingdoms up to that time, and Rome was the kingdom that was in power during the time that the book of Revelation was written. And yet there would be a united Roman Empire in the last days with 10 kings. John specifically says they are not yet. They are still future. And then the world kingdom, final world kingdom, would be the kingdom of Antichrist. Hitchcock, who wrote an article on this, says this way: "The successive kingdoms view avoids the nebulous nature of the symbolic view. just kind of, oh, these are just kind of kings and kingdoms and really not trying to specify who they really are. It's consistent with Old Testament imagery from Daniel 7, and it provides a consistent interpretation of the eight kings, because they're all kingdoms. For these reasons, it is the preferred view. Therefore, Revelation 17:9-11 offers no support for the early date of Revelation based on the idea that Nero is the sixth king. Here's what I think is what we've got happening with these various entities. We have the book of Revelation talking about a future worldwide rule. And that political system of the world, when we get to the rule of Antichrist, it's going to be in the line of what this chapter calls the seven heads. They are consecutive kingdoms of history, the seventh one being future. A revived Roman kingdom based somewhere in Europe, maybe Rome itself. And then we are going to have 10 divisions in the world that Antichrist will actually rule over. These will be simultaneous kingdoms, and they're specifically said to be future, and they're at the same time that Antichrist living. Does that look familiar? Do you see the alignment even right now in our world? We have alignments of South America, of North America. We have alignments of an African Union. We have alignments in Europe, in Asia, and ASEAN, even South Asia, etc. And then the beast, who is called the eighth king, somehow is associated with Rome. He controls the other eight, the other 10 kings, and so therefore he has a worldwide rule, yet future. Is this the European Union? It's probably comprised some of the countries of the European Union. And it was quite interesting when the European Union was formed, the second election of the European Parliament, they came out with a stamp that showed a woman riding a beast. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, but it was proposed at the end of World War II that if the whole world could just get into 10 different kingdoms, then there wouldn't be another world war again because all these kingdoms would be able to work together. It never came about, but the United Nations did come about after World War II. And this alignment of 10 different regions in the world, we're only one step away from it with the UN just putting people together. So does that explain who the seven kings are, the 10 horns, and also the beast? I hope we got those three down. Now, how about the hard one? The hard one is the Babylon the Great. Who is this woman who's riding the beast? Who is this immoral but attractive harlot? Well, the passage says that I'm going to call her End Times Babylon to distinguish her from the earlier Babylon, that she actually rules over the kingdoms of the earth. You see it in verse 2, because verse 2 says, I'll show you the prostitute. The kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated by the wine of her adulteries. So she obviously has tremendous influence over the world. And by controlling the kings of the earth, she controls all the peoples of the earth. And yet, she's at first sitting on the beast, riding the beast. She's controlling Europe. She's controlling the Antichrist. And she's controlling the seven heads, and she's controlling, to some degree, the 10 horns. But she's later destroyed by the beast. This is what we find in chapter 7. Because the beast desires to rule over the earth. And so there's major political power struggle here. And the beast will actually turn against her and kill her. So she is later destroyed by the beast, even though she initially is very powerful over the beast. Now, I know what you're thinking. Yeah, you keep saying she, but who's she? Well, let me give you some of the views, hopefully not confusing to you, on the identity of end times Babylon, the harlot. Who is she? Some people believe that she is the world system, just the whole world controlled by Satan that's seeking to fight God. Others say she's a religion. We've got various religions proposed. Others say that this image of this woman is actually a city, and then others say a nation. So how do we deal with this? I will spare you my 17-page study on this. But if you want to know the details, go to my website and click in the Revelation series, and you can read the whole 17 pages where I interact with all these various views. Okay? But I'm merciful to you. I'm not going to inflict all that on you. But I will give you just a little bit of an introduction to what these are. Some say this is the world system. The world system of materialism, pride, greed, and idolatry against God. Could this be the world system? Well, many who we are theologically akin with would agree with this. I would say in response to that, but Babylon will be ruined in 1 hour by fire. If we jump up to chapter 18, verse 17, it says, in 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin, specifically by fire. So I would say, how can people who are part of the world system stand off and mourn the demise of the world system? You know, these are people who are unbelievers, and they're in boats, and they're looking at the destruction of Babylon afar. Babylon must be some kind of geographical entity. We also saw last week in chapter 16, verse 19, it says, the great city of Babylon, in conjunction with the seventh bowl, split into three sections, and the cities of the nations fell in heaps of rubble. So I would ask a similar question. How can the world system break into three geographical sections? This seems to me that actually what you've got for Babylon is some kind of geographical, political entity. Some say Babylon is a religion, though. For example, Islam. There are several writers that will say that Islam is the Babylon here. I would ask the same question. How could you split Islam up into three geographical areas? The same for the religion of Catholicism. There definitely are allusions here to the Roman Church. I have questions of whether this is actually the Roman Church. We know that that Babylon itself had many, many teachings, and once Babylon had become conquered, the people there who could not teach there anymore, they moved their center to the city of Pergamum. And if you want some details on that, go back to our message on the website about Pergamum. We talked about this is where Satan has his throne. Once Pergamum was destroyed, they actually brought the teaching even farther west to the city of Rome. And from there, from Rome, many of the Babylon mystery religion, many of their teachings ended up getting spread throughout the world. What would be some of those teachings? One of them, for example, is the idea of the mitre, the fish head. The Babylonian leaders were called keeper of the bridge, and that was the bridge between man and Satan. These Babylonian leaders saw themselves as like mediators between Satan and the people. I find it kind of interesting that when we get to history here, the leaders of Rome ended up getting called Pontifex Maximus, like Caesar, for example, which means major keeper of the bridge. And then later on, the Catholic leaders ended up taking on that same title from the Roman emperors of Pontifex Maximus. In fact, if you want to see some parallels between the Catholic Church and what Babylon had done in terms of Babylon's mistakes, it's spelled out quite well in Ralph Woodrow's book, Babylon Mystery Religion. Dave Hunt, in his book, A Woman Rides the Beast, also chronicles all this out. And what they show is that we have a lot of teachings from Babylon that have made their way into the Catholic Church. For example, the mother and child worship, mother and son specifically, that was in Babylon was the goddess mother Semiramis held her child Tammuz in her arms. Son of Nimrod, going all the way back to Genesis 10, the founder of Babylon. That same teaching ends up reappearing in Egypt, mother and son worship. In Greek teaching, among the Buddhists and among Hindus, the same concept of the worshiping the mother along with the son. And they called Semiramis the queen of heaven. We find even Israel getting caught up in this in Jeremiah 7:18. Because the woman there were following pagan worship that they got from Babylon. They were making cakes of bread for the queen of heaven, a reference here to Babylon mystery religion. And so this mother goddess, Semiramis, actually also finds its way over on into the Catholic teaching, where the focal point ends up not becoming so much the son, but the mother. In fact, last month, my wife and I were there in Rome, and we had the privilege of seeing the Pietà, I think this was the most spectacular sculpture I'd ever seen in my life. It's an absolute masterpiece by Michelangelo. But when you look at it, what's the focal point? When you look at it, what draws your eye? It's not Jesus, is it? It's Mary, right? Because Jesus actually appears smaller than Mary. And Mary's the one who faces you. The focal point ends up becoming Mary. The idea of obelisks that we have there, we have an obelisk right there in St. Peter's Square. It's about the same dimensions as the image in Daniel 3, 90 feet by 9 feet, about 10 times as high as it is wide. And believe it or not, the actual obelisk there in the Vatican is the obelisk that the Emperor Caligula, around AD 40, brought to Rome from the Egyptian temple of sun worship. Some 15 centuries later, Pope Sixtus V moved it to the Vatican as the focal point of St. Peter's Square. In fact, he imposed the death penalty if it was broken. So what we've got there is an Egyptian sun worship obelisk as the focal point of the Vatican. And that idea makes its way throughout the world as well. Even the United States. There's this pagan association that made its way on into the U.S. with the Washington Monument, which also has the same dimensions. And you could go through, if you do a little study, you will see that Babylonian teaching is simply just replicated in the Catholic Church with relics and pilgrimages, indulgences, that's paying your way out of purgatory. The whole idea of purgatory goes back to Babylon. Pontiffs, celibate priests, transubstantiation, and even Easter and winter festivals, which we would call Easter and Christmas. These things actually have Babylonian origins. So there is some involvement there. I'm not ready to say, though, that the harlot is actually the Catholic Church, even though there's how do you break up the Catholic Church in three sections? Or maybe you could say you could break up the Vatican in three sections. That's not breaking up the Catholic Church. Others say it's a religion, but it's more pervasive. It's astrology. I won't get into all that. Definitely God is, tells us to not be involved in astrology. But a one-world religion is how some people see this. Others say, no, this is an apostate church, but it's centered in Rome, because it goes beyond what we've got in the Catholic Church. And some would call that the World Council of Churches, which interestingly was formed around the same time, 1948, as the UN. And some would say what we've got there are wolves in sheep's clothing. Some would say the United Religions International, which was formed 14 years ago, is it? But this has not really become very significant. It was very popular about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, to believe that Babylon here is an actual city. It is the city of Babylon. That there's no image of Babylon that's repeated in Revelation 17. It's actually going back to the literal city of Babylon. And I used to hold this view myself. One of my professors at Dallas Seminary, Charles Dyer, said that the rebuilding of Babylon, Iraq, revealed it as the Babylon of here. And he pointed out that the medallion in 1986 in the Babylon International Festival even shows Saddam Hussein right here, right next to Nebuchadnezzar. And you can look, and sure enough, Nebuchadnezzar's nose matches Saddam Hussein. And the chins are the same, and the eyes are the same. I mean, that proves it, right? Well, most would say, no, this is not the actual city of Babylon. It's hard to imagine that ruined city of Babylon becoming the key center of the world, world trade, world religion, etc. So some say, no, this is actually Rome. And that the seven hills mentioned here would be a reference to the seven hills of ancient Rome in its former boundaries. Of course, it went beyond those seven hills. And it is true that it did have seven hills. But it says in the text that the seven hills are seven kings. So we're not looking at literal hills here, actually. So others say, well, this must be Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem has long been in rebellion to God, so that must be the great city ruling over the world. Is Jerusalem ruling over the world? It certainly isn't right now. It could, but... And then this book came out, Dr. Chan Kai Lok, who is a Singaporean. He's passed away now. He wrote a book, Who is Mystery Babylon, that I read some years back in the early 90s. And he says that this is the United States of America, which I find quite amazing. One of the things he points out in his book is Babylon must be a nation because no single city in the world reigns over the earth. And actually, we often, even now, we use the term city when in reality we're talking about the whole nation. We do that all the time. We do that about Singapore. We say Singapore, but in reality we mean Singapore. Oh, that's right. We're a city state, huh? I'm kidding. We say that about the U.S. We say Washington's response to this. In reality, what we're talking about is the United States' response to something. Or Moscow says this. And we use the city name as a synonym for the actual, the whole country. And Dr. Chan, he gives various evidences that he says that would indicate that the U.S. is actually the Babylon referred to in Revelation 17 and 18, like symbolized by a woman, just like the prostitute is a woman in the Statue of Liberty. That end times Babylon is guilty of spiritual adultery. That means she left her godly heritage. You can't commit adultery unless you've made a commitment, right? If you made a commitment to your husband, then you violate that commitment. Then you would be called an adulteress. And there's no question that the U.S. has done that. It began as a Christian nation. Mixed, yes, but still very, very Christian. Those at Plymouth were certainly believers, not without their faults. In some of the massacres that they committed. But if you look at the Declaration of Independence, you'll find that God is mentioned four times. In fact, the founding fathers, the early presidents, and the Supreme Court called the United States a Christian nation up until about 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 1948. The United States has sent more missionaries than any country in the world in the 1900s. In God We Trust is the national motto, has been since 1954. And believe it or not, the preamble of every single state among the 50 states appeals to God for help. I've read the preamble of all 50 states, every single one of the 50. mentions God in the first sentence. So I think it's, you really have to prove your point to say that the U.S. did not start with a very, very strong Christian heritage. Jesus was held in the highest regard up until recently in the United States. And that's why it's required by law to put "In God We Trust" on every coin. Of course, there is the new U.S. dollar that tries to follow the "In God We Trust." It doesn't seem like it appears there, but if you look on the side of the coin, you'll see that it actually does appear there. But it's kind of a little masked, you know? Like some who would want to claim the name of Jesus, but kind of quietly. President Obama was famous for saying, "Whatever we once were, we're no longer just a Christian nation. We are also a Jewish nation, a Muslim nation, a Buddhist nation, a Hindu nation, and a nation of non-believers." And of course, that brought a lot of reaction from various people for him to say we're no longer a Christian nation. It's certainly true that the U.S. has left its godly heritage, but even that issue is debated. We have various books that have come about whether America is a Christian nation. Some say yes, definitely is. Others say no, and others say, like Newsweek, it's declined. We do find some similarities between the U.S. and some of the things that's said about Babylon here. That can't be denied. Like the pervasive outreach of the United States is similar to what you find in Revelation 17 and 18 about this nation that is impacting the whole world, like in the area of trade. It's compared to Tyre. Tyre was the key nation in the Mediterranean that was known for its bronze and ivory and glass and wool. And Tyre had ships that went all throughout the ancient world. They were the great seafaring people. And so we see the Phoenicians with Tyre as their capital, prominent in their relationship with David, with Hiram, and King's Hiram of Tyre, helping Solomon, and the export of all of these various things that are mentioned actually in Revelation 17. And she's actually even called a harlot. And it's certainly the case that the wealth in the United States has increased dramatically over the years, since 1945, where there was just less than $1 trillion net worth in the U.S. households, and now is up to 70 million, has dropped in recent years. And it's, really dropped. Why? We've renamed our motto, "In God We Trust," to "In Greed We Trust." And you know some of the things that's happened. But nevertheless, the U.S. is still quite prominent. And the U.S. is involved in controlling other nations, just as we see Babylon doing here. Whatever this entity is, it's going to be destroyed, and it's going to be destroyed in 1 hour. And that certainly could happen to any country today. Because we have not just Russia, but many countries with nuclear weapons. What is it, about 7 or 8, 9 countries throughout the world right now that have nuclear weapons? Babylon is said to be very self-absorbed, and that certainly describes U.S. hedonism. The most overweight people the world has ever known. The U.S. is glorified, often glorifies itself. The U.S. is involved more than any other country in the occult. And many have studied actually the dollar bill and pointed out many of the dimensions, indications of the dollar bill itself that indicate the occult. And what about immorality? Need I tell you about the similarities between the United States and Babylon in terms of immorality, both heterosexual and homosexual, internet, and every other way? It's a shame and disgusting to see. And it also says in chapter 18 that this Babylon, your merchants were the great men of the earth because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. The word for sorcery there is pharmakia, which is the word that we use in Greek to get our word pharmacy. It has really the idea of drugs. And I'm shocked every time I go back to the U.S. to see how many people are on drugs. I meet people who take drugs to get to sleep, take drugs to get awake, take drugs to lose weight, take drugs to gain weight. It's incredible how many drugs are consumed in the United States. It's appalling. It also says about Babylon, she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so match it now with torment and sorrow. She boasted in her heart, I am a queen on my throne. I am no helpless widow, and I have no reason to mourn. Here's a nation that is very, very much proud. And that's really what Nietzsche was saying. And the U.S. has followed in Nietzsche in that idea. And yet God has the last word. It says many prophetic voices were killed by this nation as well. And some say, well, that doesn't really describe the United States. But it depends on what you mean by prophetic voices. If you're talking about prophetic voices that have been killed in the womb, the answer is over 55 million people who have been killed in the womb. Well, there are problems, though, with seeing the U.S. as Mystery Babylon. One of them is the national symbol of the U.S. is not a woman, but it's the bald eagle. Claims that Russia is the beast. That's what Dr. Chan says. That has to be proven. I'm not so convinced of that. He talked about the U.S. being destroyed in 1993. That's a little bit problematic, isn't it? It kind of dates your book if you say that this country is going to be destroyed when it's written in 1991 or 92. You know, nobody wants to buy the book after 93, right? And there's a lot of theological problems with the book. So who or what then is Mystery Babylon? Well, nobody really can identify Babylon with certainty, I believe. We can have all these different theories, but I don't think it is the world system, or it's a city, or it's a confederation of nations. If I had to put my money down on one thing, I'd probably say it would be the U.S., but nobody really knows. And just because the U.S. is the most prominent world power right now doesn't mean it's going to be in the future. And none of us knows when this is actually going to happen. So who could say? I don't really think anyone can, except God. He alone knows. But I think it's going to be evident once it's here, and people will know about it. What we do know is what we find in the text. And the text says the Antichrist will destroy end times Babylon when he heads a confederacy of 10 nations in the second half of the tribulation. This is right at the end, right before Christ comes back, where we see Babylon destroyed. And I'm kind of won over with the eight successive kingdoms view here that says that that this final Gentile world kingdom of the Antichrist is actually the one that's going to be destroying whatever this entity is called Babylon. We do see over and over in verses 7 to 14 that she's the one in control because she's riding the beast. She's sitting on the beast. She's controlling the beast. And and yet, when you get to verse 15, you see that the beast actually kills her. Verse 15, then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. And so what we find here in this chapter is that this world's key entity is going to fall. I can't say I know what it is, but it will be the most powerful entity in the world, I think a geographical entity, and it's going to get destroyed. So then, why reject the world and embrace God's kingdom? That was one of the questions I said we would answer at the beginning. The reason we should reject the world and embrace God's kingdom is because the world's key influence will be replaced with Christ's kingdom. And you have to make a choice today as to which kingdom to follow. I'll put my money on the one that's going to last, not on the one that's going to be taken out of the way. And I'm trying to do all I can to live for this kingdom that's really going to last. And I know many of you are as well. We see in chapter 18, after all this, I saw another angel come down from heaven with great authority, and the earth grew bright with his splendor. He gave a mighty shout. And this is what he shouted about this harlot. He said, Babylon has fallen. That great city has fallen. She's become a home for demons. She is a hideout for every foul spirit, a hideout for every foul vulture and every foul and dreadful animal. For all the nations have fallen because of the wine of her passionate immorality. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her because of her desires for extravagant luxury. The merchants of the world have grown rich. Oh, she was beautiful, just like ancient. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Great beauty, but in the midst of it also great immorality. And so God says, come out of her. And you wonder, people will say, come out of her. Why come out of her? There's so much luxury and beauty and all these things. God says, because she's not going to last. So don't get caught up in the now. Look at the future. Like verses 4 to 7 say, then I heard another voice calling from heaven, come away from her, or come out of her, some of our translations say, my people, do not take part in her sins, or you'll be punished with her. For her sins are piled as high as heaven, and God remembers her evil deeds. Do to her as she has done to others. Double her penalty for all her evil deeds. She brewed a cup of terror for others, so brew twice as much for her. She glorified herself and lived in luxury, so match it now with torment and sorrow. I think the key phrase here is, come away from her, or come out of her. That's the command. And God says she's going to be destroyed and the earth is going to mourn. Beginning in verse 9 of chapter 18. And the kings of the world who committed adultery with her and enjoyed her great luxury will mourn for her as they see the smoke rising from her charred remains. They'll stand at a distance, terrified by her with great torment. They'll cry out, how terrible! How terrible for you, O Babylon, you great city. In a single moment, God's judgment came on you. Do you see what they're doing? They're standing off from afar and they see Babylon's destruction. That's why I don't think this is really the world system here. And it says the merchants of the world, like the businessmen, are looking at her from afar and saying, ah, alas, she is totally, totally destroyed. In fact, three times in the chapter, it says Babylon will be ruined in 1 hour by fire. Verses 10, 17, and 19. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. The only way I can imagine a city or a nation being destroyed in 1 hour by fire is by nuclear weapons, or atomic weapons, or nuclear weapons. It has to be more than just a conventional fire. The great fire at Rome that destroyed much of Rome took 8 days. The great Chicago fire was about 7 or 8 days. I mean, these destroyed cities, but no city's ever been destroyed in 1 hour by fire, except maybe Hiroshima or Nagasaki. it's going to happen so quickly that it's illustrated with a huge boulder. In verse 21, then a mighty angel picked up a boulder from the size of a huge millstone. That's almost as tall as a man. A millstone at that time for grinding grain was quite large. You can imagine how quickly that would sink. He threw it into the ocean and shouted, just like this, the great city Babylon will be thrown down with violence and will never be found again. The harlot's going to sink, whoever she is. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again, verse 23 says. The happy voices of brides and grooms will never be heard in you again, for your merchants are the greatest in the world, and you deceive the nations with your sorceries. In your streets flow the blood of the prophets and of God's holy people and the blood of people slaughtered all over the world. So you see what the world's doing? The world mourns. Why? It can't trade anymore. A lot of people made a lot of money over Babylon. They're not going to make any money anymore. And therefore they mourn. Earth's mourning is contrasted when we get to chapter 19 with heaven's rejoicing. Chapter 19 says, after this I heard what sounded like a vast crowd in heaven shouting, praise the Lord! Salvation and glory and power belong to our God. His judgments are true and just. He has punished the great prostitute who corrupted the earth with her immorality. He has avenged the murder of his servants. You see, heaven has a completely different idea about this. And again, their voices rang out, praise the Lord, the smoke from that city ascends forever and ever. Why does heaven have such a different view? Because he sees God's values and sees how God has to be consistent with his holy nature and judge sin. And every one of us, in our heart of hearts, really wants God to judge sin. We don't want sin to go unpunished. And what we find here, we get to chapter 19, is this another tremendous image called the marriage of the Lamb and the wedding supper of the Lamb. That's just looking at right what's going to happen following that is the return of Christ. And we're given an invitation in verses 7 and 9. I'll read it from New American Standard. Let us rejoice and be glad and give the glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and her bride has made herself ready. It was given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. And then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are true words of God. You want to go to that supper? You want to be part of that marriage? What is it? Well, there's different views, as you can imagine, on this one as well. We pretty much consistently here teach that Christ is going to come for the church before the tribulation, and then he'll come back at the second coming. And if that's the case, this wedding of the Lamb is actually what's going on in heaven probably at the time of the tribulation on earth. And then the supper, obviously the supper takes longer than the wedding. That would be this long rule of Christ after the tribulation. Tribulation lasting only 7 years and the millennium lasting 1,000 years. So I think what we've got going here is we have a wedding, a short wedding, relatively, in verse 7, talking about the tribulation that takes, the wedding is the church marrying Christ in heaven during the tribulation time. And then Israel being invited into the millennium on earth like friends invited to a wedding feast. And there's a lot of verses on that that I'll spare you, but here's basically, I think, what these two chapters are saying. The world won't last, but Christ's kingdom will. Which raises a question, if the world won't last, where should my values, where should your values be? Babylon is not going to last. Whatever this Babylon is, it's going to be destroyed. But Christ's kingdom will last. So whatever the Babylon is, we have seen here that this world's key entity will fall in the tribulation. But the world's key influence will be replaced with Christ's kingdom. We have to have the world's kingdom removed before Christ's kingdom can be ruling this world that we'll see when we get into the next chapter in chapter 20. And so God says, there's a lot of verses here, but let me see if I can simplify it all down to one verse in terms of where does it come show up for you and me. There's only one command in these 2.5 chapters. One command. It's in chapter 18, verse 4. It says, come out of her. Come out of her. Don't be part of that world system that Babylon is so entrenched in. You are part of the bride. How do you need to come out of her? God says that the bride has made herself ready. This is not Christ making her ready. In some certain sense he does because he redeems her. But there's something that the bride needs to do to make herself ready. Jeremiah chapter 24 illustrates this idea of coming out of a city destined to destruction through the figure of figs. Jeremiah is told that there are good figs and there are bad figs inside Jerusalem. If you're a good fig, you're going to leave and you're going to give yourself up to the Babylonians. Interesting, huh? We find a similar teaching when we get to the book of Hebrews. It's also leave Jerusalem. There was a siege wall that the Romans put around Jerusalem in AD 70. And the author of Hebrews says Jesus suffered and died outside the city. Jesus wasn't in the city. Once the city was full of sin and likewise, so let us go out to him outside the camp and bear the disgrace he bore. I think what the writer of Hebrews was telling the people is Jerusalem's going to get destroyed. Get out. And that's what we know from history that God told the Jews so they weren't destroyed there. So how do you need to come out of her? How do you need to come out of Babylon? I pray that your heart and your just everything about you by being at this church desires to be a godly man or a godly woman, a godly boy or a godly girl. We try to give a priority on purity here at Crossroads. And if I can be real honest with you, some people don't want to be part of us because of that. That's not you. You're here. But we've had many people over the years who want to bring their sin into the church. And we tell them, I'm sorry, we can't condone that. And then they end up leaving. I'd rather that we repent. I'd rather that we come out of Babylon, so to speak. Wouldn't you? How do you have that happen to you? Look at your eyes. What do your eyes see? You know, what did your eyes see today before you came here? What do your eyes see each day? Where are they looking? Does it make you more of a godly person? Or does it hinder you? What about your ears? What do you listen to? Do you listen to godly advice? Do you listen to the kind of advice that Babylon has? What about your lips? What do you speak? What kind of advice do you give other people? what kind of words come from your mouth. They start in your heart, but they make their way into your lips and your mouth. Your hands. What do you do? Are your hands active in serving the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the one who is going to last forever? And your feet, is it the same? That your feet, that they walk where God wants you to walk. That you never find yourself in a place that you would feel uncomfortable having Jesus right next to you there, because you know that he is right next to you. Invisible, but he is right next to you. Is the Lord putting something on your heart in that regard? Are you also putting on the full armor of God that we find in Ephesians 6? Are you using the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, daily in your life? Do you have the shield of faith that protects you from Satan's attacks in you?